talk about what is broadband. Very simply, without going into the technical details, broadband is faster. And faster doesn't just mean getting things done faster. Faster allows you to do completely different things. So I compare it to the telegraph and the telephone. With the telegraph, you have bits per second. You have Morse code. With the telephone, you are talking to someone. You can hear them. You can hear the inflections. You know what it's like to talk to someone. You know the difference between a message and an actual phone call. Now, I have some further reading up there on the failures of our own FCC, but in the interest of moving further, why is broadband important? One of the interesting things that's going on today is that as the quality of broadband increases, comparable offline services are declining in value. Many websites are now built exclusively for broadband. If you have dial-up, you are virtually shut out of a large portion of the internet. The government is going online. I downloaded tax returns from the IRS. I'm glad I did it from broadband. I'm glad I didn't have to do it off of a dial-up line. And there are other critical services. It isn't just e-government, and it isn't just at home. Broadband nowadays is also critical for business. We are exchanging presentations. We're exchanging emails. If you are doing business with the government, you are probably submitting bids over the internet. If you are looking for stimulus cash, you uploaded your application to the internet. All of this is a big change. This is like the difference between the telegraph and the telephone. This is allowing you to do things that you could not do with just dial-up. Now, another thing you can do is you can get information. And one of the information sites you can go to that I strongly recommend is pewinternet.org. Most research sites sell their research. If you want to go to Forrester or Jupiter or any of these other places, they will charge you money. The Pew Internet is free, and they do great research. And here are two good examples of the impact on citizen engagement. Of how many people here voted on September 15th? I hope you researched some of your decisions on the internet. You would have made a better decision if you had. Those of you who did vote, according to the Pew, it's likely that you have broadband at home. If you have broadband, you are more likely to be engaged. And I think democracy is important to the United States. If broadband helps improve democracy, that's a good thing. But broadband can also help you deal with tough times. This Pew report on the internet in the recession was very interesting. We've heard various reports about the unemployment rate. Of the people the Pew interviewed, 14% had lost their job in the past year. Some of them had gotten another job, but 14% is a very high number. In addition, 60% of those they interviewed used the internet in some way to look for a job, to find out what jobs were out there. In this sense, the internet helps you deal with the current problems we all are experiencing. So who has broadband? Well, obviously, rich people have broadband. 63% of adult Americans have broadband at home. Again, my source here is the Pew Internet. The average price is going up. Now, this is very interesting. In a recession, the price of broadband is going up. It's going up fast. I think some of our other speakers can talk about the lack of competition that is enabling broadband providers to raise prices by over 10% a year during these tough times. And at the bottom, you'll see another Pew report. Recession could lengthen the twilight of dial-up. As broadband gets more expensive, more people are unable to pay for it. Because these prices are going up, and again, we'll talk more about why these prices are going up, people are being left out. One of the reasons that people are being left out and prices are going up is that there is a virtual monopoly in the United States. In some cases, it's a duopoly. the picture is not a solid Ma Bell owning everything, but 19 companies in the United States have 93% of broadband subscribers. We have an ongoing solution to this problem. The FCC has allocated $7.2 billion to the broadband stimulus aimed at poor and rural areas. But we are having problems. U.S. broadband growth is the slowest it's been in 8 years. And we're falling behind other countries. Jolie mentioned South Korea. Then there are questions about the FCC. I've cited some sources there. How, to what extent, will the FCC be influenced by lobbyists? The Obama administration is supposed to be lobbyist-free, but the FCC just hired a lobbyist to help develop its broadband plan. Perhaps we can learn from other countries. Canada gives us a perfect example of what not to do. Canada has just decided that the Bell Company can restrict the monthly usage not only of its own customers, but of every ISP in Canada. There's more details of the article cited there. In Australia, we have a move from a bad ISP run by a former US telco guy to some positive developments, including, as they say, admitting you have a problem is the first step. The Australia's biggest ISP admitted to lying. We hope to see reforms in the future. That's an ongoing story. You can watch it every day. And British Telecom in England. The BBC is a resource that every English person pays a monthly charge for, or it amounts to an annual fee. In a sense, BBC content is owned by the public, paid for by the public. But British Telecom has decided that people should be able to access it only in a somewhat limited way. Finally, if you're interested, again, for further reading, we have a list of various broadband speeds around the world. Tell you what, the United States is not number one. So my conclusion, the real point here is broadband is not a luxury. It is a utility, it is a necessity, it is very important, and it is becoming more important every day as it becomes a part of our daily lives, as services that are not provided over broadband become less valuable, the services that are delivered over broadband become more necessary. There are still threats to that. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act is a extrajudicial system. It is one of the only laws on the books of the United States where you are guilty until proven innocent. And recent proposals have the music industry asking, as punishment, that subscribers be cut off from the internet. I obviously think that is a very bad idea, because broadband is not a luxury. Broadband helps you find a job. It helps you do your job. Most of us do some of our work from home. Those of us who don't do some of our work from home would like to be able to work from home. It is an important part of interacting with the government, with the IRS, and now with the new Obama administration initiatives, there is more information than ever about the government available on the internet. Finally, everyday things. I've just put a few things down here that I've used it for. I've read a bus schedule. I read the news every day. I'm sure you can think of everyday things that you do on the internet that are easier on the internet than they would be offline. And finally, of course, you can get this very presentation off of SlideShare on the internet. And again, that will be easier with broadband. With that, I would like to open it to questions.
Yeah, I wonder about the larger context. For me, what is emerging, has emerged over the 18 years since the web began, is a digital planet, a digital nation that in a way represents the most massive migration in history, that people, that universal broadband is fundamental. That is a different economy.
Right.
The laws of conservation of mass and energy are not a constraint to wealth.
And you're seeking from the point of view of someone who sees the whole world.
Right, and I also see it as an ecological thing. The web actually was the first page that Tim Berners-Lee put up. It was a few days before the third preparatory committee meeting for the Earth Summit. Mm-hmm. And it represents, I believe, the sustainable path that we called for. Where video conferencing, for example, there's an excellent article about Cisco in the recent Economist,
yes,
about using video conferencing. The ecological impact of that is tremendous. We're able to have an intelligent transportation system. Yesterday I was late for somewhere, running late, and my internet was totally slow. And I couldn't figure out, you know, I wanted to get directions from Google Maps, figure out the quickest way to get there. You know, it took me 3 minutes and nothing happened. So there's a world in which we live, which the whole philosophy, the way of thinking, the cooperative, the open source, the nature of the public domain, and the ability to contribute and participate, and the freedom of speech. I mean, freedom of speech in the past,
yes,
has really been limited to people who could write.
Yes, yes.
But many, many people, and I include myself among us, have a very difficult time expressing themselves. So that freedom of expression, as well as freedom of access to information. If you look at the news site, so much of it now is streaming video.
Right, and we should...
And you can get a much greater depth of any different topic by seeing it and hearing it.
Such as the Iranian election.
Yeah. So I think it's really a millennial transition to a sustainable path and ecological way of being. The ecology of the system and the ways of thinking, and that we need to be able to move into that. The degrees of freedom of the system is limited.
That's right. Those are two very good points about democracy and about our continuing struggle to make the Earth sustainable for an ever-increasing population. And of course, it's worth mentioning that on Tuesday, one of our speakers will be someone who was involved in the Iranian election. So you'll be able to see more of this at One Web Day on Tuesday in Washington Square Park.
Talk about the importance of a symmetrical broadband connection.
We could talk about that. Is that part of your presentation, Phil?
Not specifically, but just from what you were saying about sharing things in video and audio, that it's not just about watching the news, right? It's also about putting that out. And it seems like that's something that is really up for debate in defining what broadband is, whether it's a symmetrical connection or not.
Yes, and in fact, the definition of broadband is an ongoing fight at the FCC. It's a great time to submit comments. My friend Joe Plotkin, I think this is a big issue for him. He says that when an ISP delivers a powerful downloading feature and a less powerful uploading feature, this is a disincentive to participate in the multiplicity of voices that make up the World Wide Web. Whereas, on the other hand, if you have a symmetrical connection where you can upload as fast as you can download, then it encourages speaking as well as consuming.
And participating in peer-to-peer.
Yes.
All right. Do you believe that there should be more government involvement in broadband, or do you believe that they should just sort of open it up more?
Well, pricing. If there's time. That was an extra.
Address structural separation, please.
Okay. Structural separation is the idea that the pipes should be different from the services that run over them. Now, traditionally, the internet has been viewed as a multi-layer system. The simplest version of that has three layers. You have the hardware pipes, you have the routing protocols, and then you have the services on top of them. More complex versions of that scheme go to 7 or 9 layers, but I think for these purposes, it's 3 are sufficient. The problem is that if you control the hardware and the routing protocols, it is tempting and possible to start controlling the services that run over the internet. So I and many people do believe that these should be separate companies. It is very difficult in practice to do that. We have many examples from around the world of countries that are trying to do that. The United States is not one of those. But structural separation is the idea that internet freedoms will be enhanced if the people who deliver the actual connection to your home are not also involved in selling you services, because they then will not be tempted to restrict what services you can get over your internet connection.
I spoke to Bruce Kushnick, you know, and he was down there at the broadband breakfast in D.C. just a week or so ago. He told me that he spoke to, you know, people from, you know, that were with the administration, and they told him, you know, flat out that the administration is not going to get into this. That healthcare is, you know, is they're taking on one very entrenched big lobby, and taking on telecommunications, which is another very big entrenched lobby. It's too much, and they can't do it. So it's something that very definitely people have got to make a fuss about, you know, publicly, for something to happen on this topic.
That's right.
And just as these things are not unrelated, because all of the services that you talk about are critical for telemedicine.
Yes.
And especially symmetrical broadband is critical for telemedicine, right, since it involves two-way video. So I have a feeling that even though they're not going to really get into structural separation issues, that they are going to have to start to get into issues of broadband adoption and removing the ability for telcos from restricting things like two-way video, because they will enable things like telemedicine.
Right. And I'm sure.
Certainly it would seem, you know, they have all this bandwidth they do for the triple play, but it's got, you know, they've got to open up, so if you want not to, oh God, to have those other two plays, you can take those plays from someone else on your fiber provider. It's got to be Verizon giving you Fios. Why have you got to take their phone service and their TV? Why can't you choose another TV provider and another phone provider?
Or even a phone service that's free, like Skype.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, should we move on?
We should move on.
Okay, well, he's already started talking with Dana Siegel of New York City Wireless. Now, this is a very interesting thing. The wireless, you know, we use it in our homes, and Wi-Fi it doesn't go far. But now that the white spaces spectrums are opening up and there's a new generation of devices, things could change. And I'm looking forward to hearing how they work.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned Skype. Oh, yeah.
Control.
What is it, Evan?
Control 3.
Control 3, enter 1 and
5. There we go.
Yep.
You were talking, Alex, you were talking about Skype, and, you know, one of the greatest examples that I experienced recently of the power of the internet and all of the layers working together was I spent 2 weeks in Greece on a much-needed vacation, and I got to Athens, and Greece is actually one of the places that doesn't talk a lot about it, but they've got a huge amount of mesh wireless deployment in the city, and I actually used my iPhone with Skype on the Athens Wi-Fi to make a phone call back to Los Angeles and to New York, just to let my folks and my wife's folks know that we had arrived safely and whatnot. And it was a very brief but very powerful experience for me, in that all of the stuff that I've been doing and all the stuff that we've been doing to try to get, you know, broadband deployment, Wi-Fi deployment, and all of that stuff working and worldwide just all came together with a tiny little device that I had in my pocket. And, you know, it was incredibly telling about the power of these technologies and these tools to enable people to connect with one another. So I'm going to try and be brief, mostly just give you a little bit of an explanation and a picture of the power that broadband, and especially wireless broadband, can provide to promote what I believe is the One Web Day goal or vision for this year, which is universal connectivity. And that means not just universal hardware connectivity, but universal people connectivity. And you know, we like to think about, you know, rural and third world countries as being the forefront of this fight, and in fact it's not necessarily. New York City has a lot of stuff going on that that we need to deal with as well. And you know, I give these talks and I start to think that Wi-Fi is old already. It's, you know, the technology of 5 years ago, and you know, what else is new? But you know, some of the photos that I'm going to show you that I got from this year are sort of still demonstrate the fact that Wi-Fi technology has incredible transformative power today and going forward. Just very briefly, NYC Wireless is a community wireless organization, and we build free Wi-Fi hotspots. I'm not going to bother asking the question that I normally do, which is how many of you guys use Wi-Fi in public spaces, because I'm sure that it's the vast majority. But we build Wi-Fi hotspots in New York City, and most of the city parks that have Wi-Fi are NYC Wireless hotspots, or are there because of work that we did early on. You can actually trace a lot of the growth and development of the hotspot business in general that, you know, you get at Starbucks and coffee shops around the world from the early work that community wireless people did. NYC Wireless and some NOCAD and Seattle Wireless and whatnot had done starting in 2000. But we and a lot of the other community wireless groups take a very open approach to this. We build on open technology. We use open source software. We build open source software. We help to educate people about all of this stuff as well. And truly, it's a very local issue since we're located here, but there's a worldwide network of these types of organizations. And I was mentioning the transformative power of Wi-Fi. This is a hotspot that we launched a few months ago in Clinton Hill, Brooklyn, which is at the Klassen Playground. This is a playground that's next to a school and next to a huge affordable housing development, and it was brought there by CDSC, which is the Child Development Support Corporation, which is a nonprofit that provides family services in the area. And you know, we brought the hotspot there, and this was the photo that I think is most telling. And these are all local kids. These are all kids that live in the low-income housing nearby. They go to the schools nearby, and now in their playground, they have access to the world through the Wi-Fi hotspot that's provided there. And so this is the transformative power that takes place right in our backyard. So here's some more. There's some more photos of kids actually surfing the net, and they were actually, I was very impressed, they were actually playing internet games with each other, as in, you know, they knew how to connect with each other online already, which was kind of, and they were sitting next to each other, but that's, you know, kind of thing there. This is our hardware. This is actually the newest version of our hardware. It's actually some pretty nifty technology, but if I tell you that board, what's big on here, it's this size. Really tiny, and this board provides the entirety of the internet to an area of a couple of square city blocks. It's the same hardware that goes. This is actually the hardware that we're replacing on in Madison Square Park on the rooftop of the Shake Shack there. But this is what does it, and it's really really pretty innovative. This is an example of it of slightly earlier casing mounted in a hotspot in the West Village. These are some of the antennas that we use to broadcast out the Wi-Fi. Here's some of the examples of the education that we provide. So this is an installation of a hotspot. Obviously, it's a Shake Shack, but these two students here were high school students that we brought in and taught how to do exactly the type of work that NYC Wireless does, and which is to, you know, bring Wi-Fi hotspots to public spaces. This is Terry and Ben, who some of you may know. They're board members of NYC Wireless, and this is a photo of them installing a hotspot in a low-income residents, affordable housing residents in the Bronx that we did about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago. And so one of the things that we do is we go into affordable housing developments and actually deploy universal free Wi-Fi throughout the entire building and all of this public spaces and semi-public spaces as well. This is an example or a shot of our hardware running in the basement of that same building. And you know, all it is it's a little box and you know some wires and all of a sudden all of these folks that you know that are living below the poverty line in New York City have access to the internet. This is probably something that you guys are familiar with, which is our hotspots. We're actually developing some new software, which I'll get to in a moment. This is a slightly dated image of all of the hotspots that are available in New York City, and we're actually trying to work now with the Downtown Alliance to take over all the hotspots in downtown Manhattan. We're talking with the New York City Parks Department about relaunching the hotspot program that died last year that the Parks Department had put together. Hopefully that's going to move forward, but you know, obviously
where would that funding come from them? Are they going to put out some money?
Well, that's part of the discussion. We've long believed that you know, obviously it's free for the users, but we've long believed that it's the responsibility of organizations within the city to bring funding to the table to make these things happen. It's not expensive. Each of these hotspots that we installed is you know $5,000-$10,000 up front for hardware and installation, and then you know it's the tenth of the price to operate over you know each year subsequently, and that's for sizable locations. The money that you know we're trying to get the city parks department to understand that this is not a money making scheme, but they're still mostly in that mindset. But we've made a lot of progress. As Joe Plotkin would say, when an elephant takes a step forward, you don't worry about exactly if they're going in the right direction. So, one of the things that we're working on this week, and actually this is going to be part of the Tuesday event for One Web Day, is a festival. We've done wireless art festivals in the past. This is something called the Breakout Festival, and this is Alex, you had mentioned that the internet is critical for letting people telework. And actually, as we're seeing with the current recession, that there's a mass migration out of traditional cubicles and big business, where a lot of the people that are that were laid off, or even some that weren't, have made a choice and a transition to doing work more at home, working more as contractors, wired runs pieces periodically on the transition from a traditional big business economy to a small business economy. In fact, 95% of all businesses in New York City are small businesses. But the Breakout Festival is really trying to explore what it means to take one of these hotspots and transform it into a productive workspace where you can be, where you can gather with colleagues, or you could gather with other like-minded individuals and actually accomplish your job or accomplish productive work in a more collaborative and more and a more creative way. This is just an example of some of the software that we're putting together. And actually later today from 1 to 3, which is why I had to talk a little early today, I'm heading over to Gansevoort Plaza, which is right by the 14th Street Apple Store. We're going to run a two-hour session about how to take your iPhone and turn it into an incredibly productive device for business and make it much more productive for mobile work. There's some handouts over there about the Breakout Festival, and you can pick one up, but there's a whole host of events that are going on over the course of the next couple of weeks. We're also going to take mobile hotspots that we've put together and take a trip up to down to Philly and take a trip up to Westchester and actually work on the bus and turn the bus into a co-working space and actually have a couple of hours worth of productive work while in transit as a team. So this is some pretty interesting software. This is an example of one of the listening streams, so that it can, so that while you're working in a space, you can actually, using Twitter and other social tools, you can actually keep a record of the work that you're doing or the discussions that you're having, so that you can, you don't have to worry about, you know, writing down everything. This, one of the interesting things is that when we put together the hotspots, a lot of the early discussion was about, well, what if, you know, why do we want to take people that are sitting on park benches and look and, you know, people watching and talking with each other and whatnot, and make them instead focus on their laptop screens? And, you know, there's reasons why you want to provide internet in Wi-Fi internet in public spaces like that. But there is something to that statement, and, you know, parks are great gathering spaces and great social spaces. And one of the interesting things is that some of the software that we're building now is actually enabling people to disconnect from their laptop screens and interact face-to-face in a more meaningful way, in a more social way in city parks. So we're sort of, you know, coming full circle in terms of how parks are actually used, but now we're integrating the power of the internet, the power of the web, into that experience.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
In terms of pulling people out of their laptops? Well, sure. You know, some of the software, and I'll just talk about it very briefly because we have limited time. But the software is meant to actually instrument and listen into a lot of the social conversations that are happening. And the way that the software works, the breakout software works, is that it actually pulls in all of the discussions that are happening and keeps a record of them. And a lot of the time when you're working online or when you're working with your laptop in a meeting, it's to take notes. It's to keep track of what's actually being said and being discussed and decisions that are being made. And if the software can be smart enough to pick up on these things automatically, then you don't need to focus on your laptop quite as much, and instead you can focus on the actual discussions and face-to-face interaction. Some of the other pieces of the Breakout Festival actually deal with forms of working. So there's this thing called co-working, which I'm not going to get into, but it's a very collaborative way of working with teammates and other people within your local physical space. And what we've put together is, working with co-working spaces around the country, a set of formats of work that people can experiment with and actually discover how they can be more productive in interacting with each other in public spaces. So, you know, we talk about Wi-Fi. Obviously, Wi-Fi is not the only solution. Fiber's a great solution to some of what Alex was saying. I'm sure some other folks are going to talk about it, especially Lou. But Wi-Fi has this incredible power of going just about anywhere. It's kind of like water. It goes wherever, you know, wherever it wants to. It just sort of flows. Wherever you point the antenna. And a lot of the stuff that we do in terms of bringing Wi-Fi to public spaces is focusing on bringing the internet to spaces that otherwise would be totally unserved. You know, you go into a park and no one else is going to bring Wi-Fi there. No one else is going to offer internet connections. I can't imagine Verizon bringing Fios to a city park. Or, you know, Time Warner Cable bringing their cable modem service there, but we really like to think about these as the third spaces. So you have fiber broadband at home, fiber hopefully broadband at work, and now you have these other spaces, these third spaces, where these are the increasingly common gathering spaces for people to interact with each other, both for social reasons and for work reasons. And the Wi-Fi and especially community hotspots are the way that we can get the internet and the power of the web to these spaces. And, you know, what's the future? Obviously, there's huge benefit for low-income and for underprivileged residents, especially in New York City. Unfortunately, as Alex was mentioning, that, you know, the $7.2 billion, the initial round of that money being handed out by the government is solely focused on rural and rural and
poor.
And New York City, 100% of New York City is effectively ineligible for that money. There's some ways that we may be able to get some, but effectively New York City is going to be unaffected by that money. But that doesn't mean that it's not, that
in
it wouldn't
first,
be hugely
in the first
bad.
Round.
In the first round, right. There's subsequent rounds that we don't know about yet. We may be ineligible for everything, but hopefully not. But the first round is off the table effectively. But there's, that doesn't mean that there isn't a huge need in densely urban spaces. And that's one of the things that NYC Wireless has been really pushing for very strongly, as well as a lot of folks in this room. Jolie had mentioned white spaces, and you know, one of the things that we fight for and promote, and we actually tried to help out on the white spaces debate, was to bring more unlicensed spectrum to the table. If you imagine Wi-Fi is in the entirety of the electromagnetic spectrum, it's this tiny, tiny little sliver. It's actually two tiny, tiny little slivers, 2.4 and 5.8 gigahertz, or 5.3 gigahertz. But it's absolutely minuscule compared to what is potentially out there. And we've done all of this, created multi-billion dollar industries around these tiny, tiny little slivers. What could we do if we had twice that, three times that, 100 times that? You know, all of a sudden the things don't seem quite so difficult technologically, and all of a sudden there's lots of opportunity if we can bring more Wi-Fi more spectrum to the internet in that respect. And then, you know, one of the other things, and this is a little related to the question that Joel you had about government intervention. The government actually is the one that sets the rules on spectrum allocation. And there's been a movement, although very slow, that more and more of the spectrum should be given back to the public. And after all, this is our resource. We as the citizens of the United States, and we as the people of the earth, it's effectively our resource, the spectrum, not a company's resource. And so a lot of the work that we do is also focused on trying to promote this viewpoint that, and try to get government change to give back that resource back to the people. So that's it.
Question? I'm sorry, but we've got to move on, and he has a meeting to go to, so I'm sorry. What I will say is that wireless is obviously, there's a lot to talk about here, and I think that we'll schedule another forum in the future with the Internet Society here, and you know, where we can come in and just talk about it as a whole topic.
Because, absolutely.
You know, we never got to address, you know, and you know, the new
all the new technology, yeah,
and all the new technologies.
And definitely come on Tuesday to the Web Day Festival. Not just because it's one web day, but also because
yes, and there will be the breakout festival will be at one web day on Tuesday at Washington Square Park. Okay, well, our next speaker is going to be Joshua. Joshua Breitbart is policy director of the People's Production House, which takes a lot of young kids and teaches them how to use media, how to put videos together, how to webcast those videos, and that kind of thing. But Joshua has also been very much involved in the activity of New York City Broadband Advisory Committee over the last 3 years, which has, you know, studied the whole broadband situation in the city. And he's also this year been out and active in the rest of the country, you know, looking at what's going in rural areas too. So he knows a lot about this. And his theme is that, what is it? Policy is the...
New literacy.
Policy is the new literacy.
And I'm pretty PC illiterate. So what do I do?
You can edge, a slideshow thing.
Sorry.
Bottom right.
Yeah. That? You want to do it this way? Yeah, sure. That's all right. Just seeing the images. That's all.
One more. Okay.
Ah.
And then just click the button every time you need to.
Okay, or spacebar? Or that. Okay.
Yeah. Either way.
So my name is Joshua Breitbart. Is it okay if I speak from over here? So I need to change slides. And I'm the policy director of People's Production House.
You'd be better there. I could be your next guy.
Okay, I'll go back. I'll go back and forth. Just in, it's better for the camera.
Yeah. You're right.
Oh, okay.
So policy is a new literacy. Right. So one of the things we do, we've done a lot of workshops. We've asked people to draw pictures of their experience of the internet. I thought this would be a good way to start. It's my attempt at putting a window in this room. It's always nice to be talking about the internet when it's a sunny day. But I do want to thank Evan and Jolly for the work of putting this together. And thank you all for being here. So just to take a step back, policy is the new literacy. The idea is basically that that people need to understand the technology and the policies that regulate the internet in order to truly be digital literate. We tend to think about digital literacy more in terms of the screen activities and knowing how to move through the content of the internet, but especially now as we begin to talk about how do we expand the internet, we need to have everybody be able to participate in that, not just participate once we have expanded the internet. And how do I go back? If I do that, will it go back? Yeah. Because I did want to just pick up on what Alex was saying about the internet and the recession. I haven't looked at that study in a little bit, but one of the things that struck me was not only is there a huge percentage of people who are online who are using the internet as a resource to cope with the recession, but fully a quarter or a third of those people are actually contributing information to that process, either commentary or tagging or photos or video. Which is, I think, even 11% of those people who are using the internet to cope with the recession are contributing multimedia content, which when you think about the lack of broadband symmetry and that you need additional training and technology to do that is really pretty remarkable. But the thing is that the people who are, you know, you also talked about how people who have more wealth are more likely to have access to the internet. And so ironically, the people who have the most experience, knowledge, and skill dealing with economic hardship are the people who are the least likely to be able to contribute to that discussion. So that's an example of how we're all harmed by people not being on the internet and not being able to participate in these discussions. So People's Production House has been trying to engage as many people as possible and give them the skills to participate in internet policy discussions, not just production of content and searching for information and building community online, which are also essential. So this comes out of some experiences looking at what they did in Philadelphia. Dana referenced the Philadelphia Wireless Project. There's a report that I wrote on that. And one of the things we saw at this time a number of years ago when cities started talking about universal broadband, now we have the federal government talking about it, but they were convening these broadband task forces or panels. And the panels were all experts, but they were all experts in having technology. And they were experts in having technology discussing how to reach people who don't have the technology. So from our perspective, that's really a failing of design. That if you are trying to develop policy to address the problems of not having access to technology, really the people who don't have access to technology are the experts. So one of the things we like to say is that they may be the experts in how it is, but we are the experts in how it should be. So that's one of the things we started doing, is trying to redefine the idea of experts and bring more people to the discussion. This is another example of a picture that somebody drew. This you can tell what kind of attitude the person has about the internet. And again, it's just interesting to see that people speak in very different languages. When this person thinks the internet, they think of the Matrix, you know, numbers. So now we have the federal government really just starting to talk about the ideas of universal broadband. We have the broadband stimulus funding. We have the National Broadband Plan. And the greatest thing, I think, about this funding, because $7.2 billion is a lot more money than I have in my pocket right now or that I'll ever have, and it's a lot more money than the federal government. Well, maybe not if you count tax breaks and subsidies for the telcos. But it's really been a great motivator for people to engage in these discussions. So I just on Thursday was in Detroit, and we were talking about broadband stimulus funding, but we're also in that context talking about a broader vision for what people there were calling digital justice for Detroit. And the people in that discussion were, you know, there was a web developer there and somebody who teaches IT, but it was also the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization and the Detroit Hispanic Development Corporation and the Eastern Michigan Environmental Action Council. And it's really that it's getting that broad group of people to engage in this discussion that I think has been the real power and is what we really need to capture and build on going forward as we start to look at things like how do we really build on this funding program, take it to another level, and draft a national broadband plan. So here's again, you know, how do we bring all these ideas that people are thinking up at all these levels, and how do we bring them into a real shared understanding? So this is a comment that the FCC chairman made about the National Broadband Plan, and that's going to be a process that will be open, transparent, and will allow public participation in ways that are unparalleled. And again, I think, you know, for there really to be participation, it has to not just be, you know, open to participation, but we really need to, you know, carry the energy of broad public engagement forward into the process and give people the tools to discuss their needs, not just in vague terms, but really in policy terms, so that it's not, again, you know, going back to those broadband task forces, you had a lot of public engagement, yet people show up and say, well, we need broadband, but didn't get into, you know, the details of what Alex was talking about is what is broadband. You know, what are the bandwidth speeds? What are issues of symmetry? What are the technologies, wireless, fiber? What are some of the business models? You know, Dana mentioned single sourcing as a problem. And really for people to start translating their visions and their experiences and their ideas for solutions into the language of policy and technology. So this is another picture that somebody drew about the internet. And I think it's a great metaphor for what we're just talking about because, you know, it's not enough to just have the doors be open. People need to have the motivation and the sense of their own power to go through the doors. So this is actually the logo for the program at People's Production House, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about. You know, this is basically, we're trying to think about, well, what are we trying to do? We're trying to basically get people to understand that, you know, at the bottom of this technology is just this ability to communicate. It's as simple as two tin cans and a string. You know, one person speaks, another person listens, then you speak, another person listens. And we have some pins that I'll pass around, the idea being that the internet is yours if you want it. So it can be this simple, you know, if you take that knowledge. So here's some other pictures. And I think, again, you know, these ideas of how different stakeholders and different groups of people are connected and how the internet brings those connections together, but also how the discussions and thoughts about the internet can bring lots of different groups together. This is actually from a workshop we did in South Korea. So what we did, so People's Production House started as a media production organization, teaching people how to do media production. So when we got into this, how am I doing on time, Tom?
You've got another like 5 minutes.
Okay, so I'll move through that. So we used our media production skills to engage people. So we started doing interviews and surveys to, this is a group called Adhikar for Human Rights. This is an English class for Nepali women, immigrants from Nepal, and we were surveying them to get their input into some of these ideas. And again, you were talking about how people communicate visually, so this is one of the things that we thought was important, was to give people space to share in a non-textual way. And it's actually really interesting when you get a room full of people that are, you know, policy wonks and very used to communicating you know, with black ink on white paper, and you know, you give them colored markers, and sometimes they freak out. But you know, I think, but we've also been able to generate a lot of interesting discussion with some of these ideas. This is a woman who's from Trinidad and Tobago. She's a member of Domestic Workers United. She went through our Community News Production Institute training program, where we teach community organizers to be radio journalists at People's Production House. And you know, this is her idea of the internet. It's basically, you know, her connecting to her home country, and then there's the rest of the world. Not how everybody, you know, experiences the internet, but I think one of the things we learned was that no one person has a complete picture of the internet. And when you start out this way and everybody draws their own perspective, and you see that, you know, even somebody who understands the technology or has all this technological privilege, since they don't understand the perspective of, you know, maybe somebody who's an immigrant or is new to the internet, and that the internet really is this constantly growing and shifting body of people and computers and content as everything gets added onto it, that really it's only by being open to everybody's perspective that you get a full picture of the internet. We also had people talk about some of the barriers and problems they face. So this is somebody looking over a wall into the beauty of the internet, or worried about people looking at them, you know, while they're online, their privacy, or, you know, the impact of money and commercialism online. But again, a lot of the themes are about how people are connected. And that's one of my favorites. And they're all my favorites. So we took a lot of this information, and then we worked with a group of high school students from City As School to interview some people who had very particular important knowledge. These are people from Empire City Subway that manage the conduit under New York City streets that a lot of our local internet goes through. This is Tim Lance from NIGENET, New York State Educational Research Network, or something like that, explaining their network, and this is them at the co-location facility. This is them interviewing the folks from Verizon. And talking to the folks from Verizon was really interesting because they had all these questions about dial-up, and of course Verizon just wanted to talk about Fios. So then they developed this alien as a sort of guide through as a teaching tool, and the alien takes you through the video and sort of like, well, if I was just coming to the world for the first time, how would you tell me how the internet worked? And that's one of the strengths of working with young people, is that you can go to Tim Lance or Verizon or Empire City Subway and get those kinds of answers. Whereas if I go, even though I don't know any of that technology, I've got to act like I do. So some of the stuff we'll be doing just in the near future, we'll be coming out with the full DVD version of that video. It's called The Internet is Serious Business, and it has a study guide along with it to use in classrooms or community organizations. We developed hands-on activities to go with it. Some of these ideas about policy as new literacy I'll be putting out in an essay shortly, and I do have pins that I'll pass around that look a lot like this, except smaller. These are some people from our Radio Roots program. Radio Roots is our youth education program. We teach in public schools around the city, and we have summer projects. We're going to start this fall next month, begin our new year-long courses in public schools in New York, integrating these components of internet policy and media policy into the media literacy curriculum. We're producing a new video on wireless internet, so this is them out in the street in the spring doing interviews about the use of cell phones, which is, for a lot of people in New York who don't have broadband access, they use their cell phones and use it to connect to the internet, but it's the policies regulating that are very different, so we're investigating that now. And on Tuesday, I just have 10 seconds. Tuesday we'll be putting out this paper, which we contributed to through community engagement with the Media and Democracy Coalition, called the Public Interest Internet Agenda, and we'll be making that available, releasing that in New York on Tuesday at the events in Washington Square Park. And if you want more information, this is my email address and our website. Thank you.
That's really good, Joshua. And again, it's a topic where we could have a whole meeting just on this topic. And there's one theme that was in Dana's talk and in his talk, which I think about, which is with broadband, and once you get the things like not only that and the symmetrical thing of the two-way communication, it's a point that was made in the, if you look at the video for the breakout festival, he talks about how in the original days of Wall Street, they actually, everybody gathered on the street, and then they moved into the stock exchange, they moved indoors, and everybody got into the office. And so what the breakout festival is actually, you know, going back to the point where people get out on the street. And what he was saying about policy, it's the same about policy, is that policy got removed into the halls of government in back rooms, but now with the internet, the policy is once again becoming the property of the public, and people can be involved in policy, as long as they have enough bandwidth to get involved in it. And speaking of bandwidth, our next speaker would be Lou Kletner of the Community Fiber Project, who will talk about how communities can actually, you don't have to wait for Verizon or somebody to come to your block. You can organize with your neighbors, and you can, if there's dark fiber nearby, you can hook into that and get yourselves hooked up. Are you ready to go, Lou?
Yes.
Yeah, right in the front there.
All right.
In front of the PC.
Can close that.
If you go to Strapman, oh, there it is. Isn't it around here too? Wait. No. It's on this one.
Yes.
Hi, Lou Kletner. I will probably, in the interest of time, keep this relatively short. This is since January, New York City Community Fiber has been researching the various aspects of making community-owned fiber a possibility here in New York City. So our goals would be to stop waiting for incumbent interests to provide the connectivity we want, we need now, and we know we'll need ever so much more in the future, and do so in a way that's cheaper in the long run, faster in the short run, and innovates in ways which the larger commercial interests haven't been able to. We're a nonprofit entity. Gateway2Gov, which is 501c3, overseeing this, was founded to increase constituent engagement with electeds. We view online connectivity as a prerequisite to successful engagement. Our goals are to design something that's fast, equitable, and centered around the end user. Instead of viewing network design from a network owner standpoint, to view network design from an end user standpoint. And what are the aspects that we feel are important in terms of choosing service providers, in terms of having the costs associated with service be in line with actual construction costs and operational expenses beyond that. We've drawn a lot of inspiration from ImagineNet, which the New York State Education and Research Network, and as well as the Broadband Advisory Committee, which held a series of hearings in each borough detailing the impediments to access and accessibility and cost comparison to the international markets. Dynan report, which basically provided an independent study of New York City's broadband marketplace. Most interestingly, they forecasted a need for 100 megabit symmetrical connectivity by 2010. So that's less than 3 months away. Do you think we're going to make it? Then came this broadband stimulus opportunity, the first of its kind from the national level. The state had put some very small level funding out in the previous 2 years. So this is the first time any kind of sizable funding appeared. So the first round, as you know, previously mentioned, it was very difficult to apply for infrastructure funding in New York City. Some entities have made an effort at that. We'll see in the coming weeks whether that effort will yield any funding. Here, slide, courtesy of Tim Lance, although courtesy probably of Telegeographer, showing all the landings. These are all international transatlantic or transcontinental fiber optic cables owned by different entities that all terminate or land here in New York City. So in terms of global internet connectivity, it's all happening right here, and it's all happening a few blocks from here. So we're, as local communities here in New York City are kind of uniquely positioned in that the peering points where you access the public internet and the variety of different networks that consist of the public internet are located right here in New York City. And they exist in other places, but in terms of your choices on the East Coast, New York's looking good. So a little bit more about NASRnet. They're 501c3. Their charter is to connect universities, educational and research institutions, as well as healthcare facilities. They were in a situation where the individual members were paying tens of thousands of dollars a month apiece for connectivity that was insufficient for their needs. So they formed this nonprofit entity to solve their collective bandwidth needs. They met in the summer of 85. By the winter of 85, they'd gotten a series of institutions to pledge the funding needed to get it started. By 2 years, less than 2 years later, they launched their first R&E IP network in the country. Good New York first there. They did substantial upgrades over time. Most significantly, I suppose, would be for New York City. In 2000, they began to discuss the feasibility of doing a fiber ring in Manhattan. And they spent about 2 years, researching the feasibility, what would the costs entailed be, what are the challenges. And in the spring of 2002, they decided to begin construction of that network. They issued an RFP. They selected a master contractor. And by the winter of that year, they connected a series of sites in Manhattan, built their central hub, and were fully up and running with all the connectivity those entities could possibly want. And the form of the network is dark fiber. So if there's no specific link speed, every entity can light their fiber at whatever rate they'd like. So this is a long-term solution with a fixed cost in terms of the dark fiber. We have some, what we're proposing is that in a series of New York City neighborhoods, we build a, say, 10 by 10 block area, last mile networks, which lead to a middle mile backhaul to a data center peering fabric in which a number of different ISPs or ASPs can offer services as well as connectivity to the public internet. In a potential collaboration with academic institutions or those which have had means and the wherewithal to procure their own dark fiber middle mile, we could have an anchor institution that sits in the middle of a CUNY or an entity that has provisioned their own dark fiber back to a data center.
So you're talking about really piggybacking on?
Yeah, sharing that middle mile.
Yeah.
The cost of electronics is not insignificant, but it's a marginal cost in comparison to the cost of construction or the cost of leasing another fiber. So this would be a way where the institution has secured this link right here, this link to the data center, at a fixed cost, and usually on a 10-year term. So their costs, they know their long-term costs on that. What we can offer to them is, you've always wanted to help out the surrounding community. Allow us to work with your middle mile connection. We'll jointly fund an equipment upgrade so that your university has more bandwidth, and bandwidth is made available for the surrounding community. And we'll handle the connectivity to individual homes.
So to make it clear, these people, this is really a dumb pipe until they get, and they would have to decide which of the ISPs or the ASPs they would buy their services from.
Yes. The idea.
So these people will be paying one amount of money to you for the dumb pipe that reaches the service provider,
okay,
and then another sum of money to the service provider.
Yes.
So they would connect them to the
internet. So it is divestiture in the sense of the infrastructure, the facilities-based provider isn't offering application services alongside. We don't say, here's our voice video, buy a triple play from us. We say, get on board with the community fiber, and then you can choose from any number of providers at the other side, which can offer any number of services.
So that is structural separation.
That is structural separation.
In action.
Yeah. We feel that as end users, this is the most desirable thing. You don't want vendor lock-in in terms of which services are made available, what you know, collection of video content or other, you know, value-added services are layered in there. So this is this would also be a very competitive playing field. The cost of establishing a presence in a data center and becoming an ISP or an ASP is measured in the tens of thousands of dollars. The cost of constructing last mile networks to individual customers is much higher than that.
As I understand it, to lay cable, you have to be a franchisee, and you're supposed to pay down, $2 million as a deposit before you can be a franchisee. How are you going to deal with that?
Yeah, I think we have a slide in here that details that a little bit. So some of the steps required here, this is the New York City franchise requirement, the local high-speed telecommunications franchise, as they call it, requires $1 million security deposit or irrevocable letter of credit. Certainly a challenge for most community groups to come up with that. It requires payment of 5% of gross revenues, $200,000 minimum a year. And there's no exceptions for non-commercial community group entities. It takes about 6 months to do.
Do you think there's a chance that law's going to get changed? That you've had discussions, have you?
We have had discussions. They're working on a revision or a process change. Whatever change in the franchise process will be retroactively applied to all the other franchise holders. So in order for the city to continue doing business with its existing franchisees...
They couldn't make two classes of franchise?
Well, every franchise agreement they issue, if they put a new right of privilege in it, is applied to the previous franchises. So they have to create a new section, a new area for community groups, or they need to enable us to get on board and collectively put up the security deposit or get a waiver on the security deposit, which is really a guarantee of revenue. That $1 million is really guaranteeing your first 5 years of $200,000 minimum.
Okay.
That's separate from security deposits for use of the conduits in the street, for pole attachments, or any case where you might injure,
you might damage infrastructure.
Do you mind if I ask you a question? I hope you don't see it as threatening, but it's a sort of reality check. I actually had a word with the deputy mayor just 2 weeks ago.
I'm sorry to interrupt them. thing is, we're actually on a very limited schedule, and we've got one more speaker, and we're supposed to finish at 2.
Okay.
And so, you know, this is an interesting topic. And what I will say is that on the Internet Society's website, isoc-ny.org, there is a complete presentation and lots of discussion on the Community Fibre project. And I recommend everybody, you know, if you're watching online, that you go to the website and look at that, and you know, and you can deal with that. So finish up here.
Mm-hmm. More regulatory, Kalia. So we've taken a number of steps exploring the legal arena and the regulatory arena, getting budgeting and planning materials in place, working on business plans. It appears that you know, the construction costs could be amortized in 8 years' time at a very low monthly fee. Buzzing through faster, looking at technologies, construction approaches. Well, we feel that construction approaches are a key aspect because of the significant costs associated. So if 95% of your construction expense is going to be people working with hanging things on poles or putting them through conduit in the street, you better understand how that process works so you can manage those expenses. One of our favorite things that's come to our attention recently is asphalt trenching, which is ridiculously easy. There's a $1,000 basically chainsaw with a asphalt cutting blade on it. It'll cut a groove in concrete like that, which they're using to affix to full light pole attachments. So I think this is actually Nextel Communications Group, or. And this is showing a progression from a manhole into a trench, through the trench, through the trench, to the pole. And there's an antenna on top of that pole. One of our, obviously a big drawback is when you tear up the street, all that work has to be redone. But if it's cheap to put in and goes in fast, some distribution techniques, again, in order to get an accurate grip on what the construction costs are, one has to understand what the different distribution approaches are, underground versus aerial backyard distribution, and the technology of pulling or pushing or blowing fiber through the streets, starting out with an electric winch to your more traditional rotter truck there, which was really designed for hauling copper cables, which are very heavy to...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we are on like a 2 o'clock deadline.
Yep.
So what I will say again is that if you go to isoc-ny.org, there is a complete presentation of Blue, you know, of this. And if you search on YouTube on Community Fiber Project, you will find Lou's presentation up there in that meeting as well.
Yep.
So I'd like to thank Lou for coming tonight. Okay, our last speaker now today is Thomas Camber from Older Adult Technology Services, and they do amazing work, and he deals with seniors, and one of the things that I really like that they do is they get kids to show seniors how to use the internet. I've talked to him, he was telling me some very interesting thing about how, you know, they're learning as they go along, that what they hadn't thought of was that seniors might like laptops better than big newfangled computers, and when they actually introduce laptops, they love them. You know, I'm sure he's going to give us a very interesting talk. Tom?
I don't have a power.
Yeah, so we kill the screen.
Just the power button, yeah. One more time.
Take the low tech option here. Thanks, Joe. As I'm the founder of Older Adult Technology Services, and about 5 years ago, I'm not actually a techie, really. I'm sitting here with a room full of people talking about all sorts of technology details that I'm always fascinated by. Originally, I was a housing person and started looking at how the digital age and the movement toward an internet-based society is giving us opportunities to solve a lot of problems that are social issues that before the internet we couldn't really get at. And so I started out working for a group that used low-income housing developments as a channel for helping connect low-income people to broadband technology. And out of that work, I met an 89-year-old woman who asked me to teach her how to use a computer. And working with her for about a year, I realized, you know, getting somebody in their late 80s online, it really lights up a person's options and connects them to a world of things that are going on that is an incredible motivator of social change. And so I want to talk a little bit today about this question. I mean, essentially, if you back up a little bit, you know, there's a $7.2 billion investment the federal government's making in broadband infrastructure, all sorts of technological issues and questions about how the money should be spent and where we're going with this. But one of the key questions that I think doesn't get asked enough is just, who's not online? And why aren't they online? Just the simple question of, if we want people to be connected to, and when I say online, I don't mean who's not using broadband technology. It's more about who's not benefiting from being able to participate in the digital age, whether it's through a phone or whether it's through the connectivity that's coming, but they don't have to be sitting in front of a PC to have this problem addressed. And of course, that brings, you know, from my perspective, I'll flag that seniors are the group that people often forget to talk about. But in terms of the numbers and what we know about it, older adults are the group that's most affected by underutilization and lack of access. The numbers are pretty clear. The Pew studies are showing the current number is 42% of older adult people, 65, I think, are online now, which means that close to 60% are not using technology in ways that can change their lives. Home-based adoption numbers, about 35% of seniors have internet access at home in senior-headed households. Then it gets worse. When you look at the Diamond study, they interviewed NYCHA households. They have about 70% utilization rates in certain parts of the study. Senior-headed households, 5% are online. 95% of senior-headed households in New York City Housing Authority are not online. They don't have connectivity. And that jives with what we've experienced going out in the communities and working with senior directors in different nonprofit organizations. There's a crisis in utilization. Some of it's an access issue. Some of it's a price issue. But a lot of it's also about demonstrating the value of technology for seniors, giving people appropriate age-relevant training and age-relevant support. And on the way we've been coming at it, thinking about ways to subsidize people's access on the consumer side. And so we've been trying to solve those problems just in a completely logical way of saying, again, who are these people? Where are they? How can we help them? What do they need to get online? So the first line of attack was there's about 100, 150 technology centers in New York City, completely underutilized. And they have very little funding out there to train people, very little funding to keep these centers up and running, to fix the simplest things like the mouse going on a computer. That machine goes offline for weeks or months. New York City doesn't have a public interest technology program where there's a stream of funding where you can apply to the city government for technology money to go help people. There isn't a program like that. And most cities don't have that. I mean, Seattle's kind of ahead of the curve, and I've been working a little bit in San Francisco, and they've got some programs for it. But by and large, this is kind of when you think about the vastness of the impact of people not being online and what the cost is to individuals, we're really underinvesting in broadband adoption support programs. Dramatically underinvesting. I mean, there's, you know, very little resources available. So what we've done is we started by developing trainings in the senior centers, and then we spent a lot of time kind of slowly cobbling together funders and supporters to support a citywide program focused on older adults. And now we're training at 30 centers across the city. We're raising about $1 million a year to do this. We taught over 1,000 people last year. We have a digital community for senior citizens that we've launched at seniorplanet.org. We got the city to focus on seniors a little bit more with their application for BTOP money. So there's a $12 million ask that the city has put in for public computer centers that is sitting on somebody's desk down at the Department of Commerce. And we help create that the senior side of that for them. We've been generating a lot of the strategy for people in terms of how to access the centers. And again, it's our way of thinking, it's just the first step to build out some of the centers and provide them with better training. But we're actually doing programs now where we've been giving away laptops to the seniors at home and giving them a year's worth of free internet access, and then providing them with 10 weeks worth of free training in the house. That we've just done that with a group of 75 people this year. We worked with Chris Goles to give away 1,100 free laptops in the last couple of years before that, not laptops, desktops. And now we have a collaboration in Brooklyn with a major hospital that where we're actually working with their geriatric department, again, giving away free laptops, full internet access, 10 weeks of free training to people at home so that they can use Health ID to connect to their doctors and health information. And what's interesting about this to me, what I just kind of want to emphasize is my last 5 minutes here, is I think that I was talking about seniors as sort of the canary in the digital coal mine, which is kind of a little bit of a mixed metaphor there. But they do say if you can help, I mean, most of the people that are interested in design, so if you can design something for the people that have the least, that are coming at the problem with the least training or the lowest skill level, then it works for everybody else. And so that's the master of the sort of, you know, when Apple does something well, you can hand it to your grandmother. I mean, they use the iPod. They would hand it to people over the age of 60 and say, see if you can figure out how to use this. And the average person, even older folks, could figure out roughly how to get a song to play on an iPod in a couple of minutes with no instructions. And if you can design things for older adults, they work a lot better for the rest of the people out there as well. So we've been thinking that as we go out and try to solve the problems for older adults, we're finding that there are implications for sort of social benefit beyond that. So I'll give you three quick examples. One is very specific to senior centers. New York City has 300 senior centers that are funded. It costs the city about $260 million a year, mostly federal draw-throughs from programs. And there's a crisis in utilization rates in the senior centers. They're underfunded. I mean, it's very broadly spaced centers. Each one of them is struggling for money. There's been a real problem in supporting and generating innovation in a lot of the centers. And so a couple of years ago, the commission of the Department of the Aging testified to the city council and said, people just aren't coming in for lunch anymore. We're losing 40% of the centers are chronically underutilized. They're giving back millions of dollars in unspent money because we can't get the seniors to come in because the centers just aren't generating enough programming that people want to take the courses. And when we came to start teaching our classes, instead of teaching a senior, you know, having a kind of an afterthought of we'll have a computer class and somebody will come in with computers for dummies for an hour a week and, you know, try to teach a class here and there, we said, again, what do seniors need to do this well? Well, they need 10 weeks worth of training. They need two classes a week. They need high-quality hardware and software programs to work with. They need a professional staff that's getting paid with health insurance to go out and teach these classes that does professional development every month. They need the kind of program that everybody should be getting. I mean, all social service programs should work like that. You know, you should, when you sit across from the desk from somebody, they should be competent. And so to solve the problem, we had to hire competent people and pay them well. And now, I just heard yesterday, it's kind of a great story. We have a center up in Castle Hill in the Bronx. We've been running programs there for about 4 years. And the center's turning 50. It's their 50th anniversary. They just called us yesterday. The seniors put together a panel that planned their anniversary event, and this Bronx Borough president was paying for this luncheon, and they want us to be the honorees. The most important thing that they can think about to celebrate their 50th anniversary as a senior center is oats. Because it's had that kind of impact in their lives. People are connecting to their families overseas, people are getting jobs, people are doing art online, people are listening to music. It's really reinvigorated the center, and people are coming into that center in numbers like they've never seen before. Because the quality of what you have to do things effectively in the digital age is leading to that kind of problem solving. Second example. Jobs. I taught a class in Bed-Stuy, again, when we were starting out at a little housing development on Gates Avenue, and I thought everybody was going to want to email and, you know, do solitaire. And so I go around the room and got my sort of, you know, armchair technology trainer's ideas about how things are going to work. What are you all here for? More than half of the seniors in the room, people in their 60s and 70s, were looking for jobs. And so, you know, of course, my curriculum was completely wrong. I had to go back and redesign 5 weeks of it. We ended up developing a 10-week workforce development curriculum for seniors. But then we started asking, what does this mean for how we give job training for older adults? Like, well, you know, for workforce training, all of the workforce training that's being delivered to people over the age of 60 is through Title V programs, and it's only reaching like 150 people a year. Well, we've got, you know, 200,000 seniors in New York that are looking for work. Most of them need training that's more focused on their sort of higher order skills around things like technology and using those skills to transfer to things like the healthcare industries, which are moving into health IT. But nobody's really been looking at that because nobody asked that question. So we got a city council hearing on this. The seniors went down. They talked to the council members about it. There's been a little bit of movement now to kind of think about how is the city doing workforce policy and how can we have older workers who really want to stay working and need to do that and contribute. How do we retrain people and bring them back into the workforce? So that's a secondary. The last piece is on the health IT front. There's $7 billion for broadband infrastructure. There's, I think it's $17 billion for health IT. It's a gigantic amount of money to get these sort of giant ossified healthcare institutions to convert their paper-based systems or their non-interoperable systems into functioning interoperable medical record systems and then light up a connection to the patients. Well, this is happening. Whether they're kicking and screaming, and there's a lot of questions about how it's happening or whether it's being done right, but I've been working with a lot of hospitals over the last couple of years, and they are moving everything online. And within the next 3 or 4 years, they're going to start opening up these portals to patients. And the Institute for Family Health is already doing it. Kaiser's been doing it. The Veterans Administration's been doing it. But, of course, as they open up these portals, the people that are over the age of 60, the 60% of people that are not online can't use those tools. Well, that starts to open up the question about what are we doing with health IT? Who owns the data? How are we serving the patients? How does the patient decide what pieces of their information are getting shared with their caregivers? So we're exploring those questions through this pilot that we're doing in Maimonides right now, and that's actually going to generate some reform thinking about how to do health, not just health IT, but how to do healthcare. And the geriatric providers are talking to us about things to say, well, now we've got opportunities where we can create sort of wellness tracking systems so the patients can monitor their own plans and then interact with us, and we can actually pick things up through some of these monitoring telemedicine devices and have a much more robust environment where we're really improving people's health and helping them live at home successfully in the much more sort of integrated community environments. So I guess my big message, my big message here on some level is as you start to reach into these digital divide questions and ask the question about sort of what are the social effects that we're looking for, as we answer them, we've just sort of taken logical steps to answer the questions to say, what does it do to get this done right? But each time you answer one of those questions in the digital, for the sort of digitally informed approach, you open up a new way to do something that we've been trying to do for 20 or 30 or 50 years and doing badly. And now we're on the cusp of doing things a lot better, and that's kind of what we were after at Oates. So I urge people to be involved in this. We're trying to help the city with a round 2B type application and see if we can make it more ambitious in terms of focusing on the social impacts. But there's a lot of opportunity here, and we've been just scratching the surface now.
Thanks, Tom. That's a great presentation. I'm sure that when we put it up on YouTube, it's going to be a runaway viral hit.
All right.
At least with the over 80 set.
I'll be driving the traffic.
And so that's it for today. And as far as the road ahead on broadband goes, I mean, the thing is about the internet is that it's still very young. We're still in the very early days, and there's a lot of development yet to do. So. That's it for today. Tonight we've got a party, which if you go to onewebday.org/NYC, there are details of that, a Software Freedom Party. On Tuesday, we will be in Washington Square Park from 12 to 2 with the One Web Day celebration. Our special guest is Gail Brewer, a city council member, and there will also be a speaker from Iran and another Skype and Open Planning Project, and we'll also have music for you, and that will also be webcast, so if you're out there, tune in, and thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.